Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us here again, Henrik with Red Ice TV. Always a pleasure seeing you guys here. Thank you so much if you're joining us at redice.tv or, of course, redicemembers.com. Big shout out to our members out there who makes shows like this one possible. We have Ed Dutton back on the show today, Jolly Heretic. He's been with us two times, I think, before. It's great to see you again, Ed. How's it going?
It's going okay. Yes, glad to see you. Good to see you again.
Absolutely. And you have a new book out, of course.
I do have a new book out.
Let me pull it up here so we can see it. Why Islam Makes You Stupid, But Also Means You'll Conquer the World. Pretty good. I like the title, let me put it that way. And it's funny.
I kind of give to my Muslim readers with one hand and take away with the other. But I think it's ultimately, although it's a provocative title, obviously, it's a fairly fair and reasonable treatment of the situation. As far as I can see, the nature of Islamic society does not just reflect low IQ, it causes low IQ, but by doing so, having low IQ seems to be correlated with being ethnocentric, being particularly negatively ethnocentric, but also to some extent positively ethnocentric. That is to say that you think your group's the best and you're prepared to make sacrifices for it and you're prepared to repel with great violence whatever the out group who you see as inferior. And we know from computer models that have been run again and again and again that it is that group which dominates the earth. That dominates the grid of other groups with different systems, such as being humanitarian or whatever. It's ultimately the ethnocentric group which dominates. Mm. And religiousness correlates with ethnocentrism. It correlates with ethnocentrism. Religiousness essentially takes ethnocentric behavior, group-level behavior, and it makes this behavior the will of God. Indeed, there's even a specific part of the brain. It's called something like the anterior frontal cortex. And if you stimulate that part of the brain, it not only makes you more religious, it also makes you more ethnocentric. So we know the two things are connected.
How was it stimulated, that part of the brain again, you said?
We magnetically stimulate this particular part.
Oh, okay, as a test, as a scientific test.
It's called posterior medial frontal cortex. So we know the two things are related. We know also that traditional religiousness does correlate with being ethnocentric, and so it's religiousness of exactly the kind you have with Islam now, fundamentalist religiosity, traditional religiosity, which makes you dominate the world, but also religiousness seems to reduce intelligence. Now, another way of dominating the world is through intelligence. That's how we Westerners have done it. The way we dominated the world was by having very, very high intelligence and ethnocentrism and religiousness, which didn't drop below a certain level. And as long as that didn't happen, then we were extremely intelligent and we were able to dominate even groups that are more ethnocentric than us, because we were able to produce all these geniuses came up with brilliant ideas, and these brilliant ideas, weapons and industry and whatever, allowed us to dominate in warfare, allowed us to dominate in conflicts with other groups, even those that are more ethnocentric than us. But in that context, our ethnocentrism, underpinned by our religiousness, hadn't dropped below a certain level. Now that it has, we're just highly intelligent but with no ethnocentrism, and this is appalling because it means that intelligence in itself is just without the ethnocentrism aspect, is negatively associated with ethnocentric attitudes. Intelligent people tend to be liberal. Intelligent people tend to have sort of low self-esteem about themselves.
Yep.
And they tend to be trusting. They tend to be open to anything new, including new cultures coming into their country and all these other aspects of intelligence, which if there's no ethnocentrism involved, you're screwed. And that's the situation we're in.
Yep.
The genius of Islam is of current Islam, contemporary Islam, Islam in the tradition of Qutub and these kinds of people, Muslim Brotherhood, this radical Islam that's now so prominent, is it gets that balance right between the need, of course, to be intelligent and the need to be ethnocentric. And it basically means that it reduces intelligence, but it makes you ethnocentric in such a way that you win out.
Now, I can think of another group that are, of course, not as numerous, but they're intelligent, and of course they're very ethnocentric as well, who in many regards have actually lobbied for opening the borders to Islam within the West, right? I don't think we set out to do that. Like, let's invite the stranger. I think that this was done to us to a certain extent. It's historically, we have similar things like the Visigoths in Spain went through kind of a similar, a little bit more violent, of course, then, but a little bit similarities there as well. I just wonder how we got to that point where we seem to be very ethnocentric and we did things that was best for us, and then all of a sudden, 50s, 60s, 70s, this just goes out the window. What happened there?
The thing is that with human relations, you do get tipping points. So it's a very interesting observation you make about all of a sudden. And there's been some evidence that's indicated that it's about 30% or 25% or something. Once 30% or 25% of a society are doubting the current regime, then they become fashionable and they have the power and they're looked up to and they're important and people start defecting to them. And there's very interesting studies on this where you'll go around a group and you'll say, you know, how many squares do you see in this picture? And it's six squares. And then somebody who's a plant says it's five. And then once a certain percentage of them start saying five, then even those that aren't plants will start saying it's five. You do have these tipping points. And so you would expect it to seem quite sudden, but I don't think it's really sudden. I think one thing is stress. So stress is associated with religiousness. The more stressed you are, the more higher the mortality salience is, then the more religious you are, and therefore the more ethnocentric you are. And stress has gone down, down, down. Mortality salience has collapsed from 40% child mortality in 1800 to 1% child mortality today. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. Mortality salience. Another thing, as I argued in a book which you interviewed me about a while ago, The Silent Rape Epidemic, and I've argued in other books as well, is this concept of the spiteful mutant, this idea that under these Darwinian conditions, we are 90% of the population every generation don't pass on their genes. 50% through child mortality and the rest through dying when they're a bit older, but they don't pass on their genes. So those that do pass on their genes are those that are optimally adapted to the ecology, and those people will therefore have very good immune systems, total lack of mutant genes in terms of the body, in terms of the immune system, whatever, and that will correlate with the lack of mutant genes in the mind. The mind is 84% of the genome. So if you've got a poor immune system, if you've got mutations of the body, you will surely have mutations of the mind. What was happening until the Industrial Revolution with the introduction of better medicine and inoculations and all this, and better public health and all this kind of thing, was that every generation these physically unhealthy people were dying as children, and that was also killing off mutations of the mind that would be maladaptive under Darwinian conditions, such as not being group selected, such as being low in ethnocentrism, such as putting the interests of another ethnic group before your own. All of these sicknesses, basically, these things that reduce your genetic fitness that we now see. And so you're going to get this build-up and build-up and build-up of mutation, which is going to be held back at the environmental level by the presence of religion, and propounding these ethnocentric values. And once the tipping point of 25% or whatever not being religious is reached, then which perhaps happened in Britain in the 60s, then the whole edifice will collapse and collapse very quickly, and you will see this flip from adaptive values, which would have been adaptive under Darwinian conditions and whatever, such that you had, even during World War II, to maladaptive values, multiculturalism, feminism, things which undermine an ethnocentric society where you're highly internally cooperative and highly externally violent and whatever. And that's what I think happened. And Islam is not in that situation. First of all, Islam comes from societies which have undergone industrialization more recently. So they've been subject to dysgenics, to the process of all of this buildup of these mutations and these spiteful. It's not just the people who are these mutants who have these mutant, weird, maladaptive ideas. They can then influence other people to behave maladaptively who are not mutants. So it's a bit like if you imagine, for example, there's evidence that if you associate as a mentally healthy person with a person who is depressed, then you can become depressed.
Right. Yeah.
There's data on that. And equally, if you associate with people who are weird and who have these bizarre and strange ideas for genetic reasons, then that can push you for environmental reasons to be bizarre and strange yourself.
Right. It's a survival mechanism, right? That your adaptability is hinging on your survivability, right? If you can, same thing with the child. It doesn't maybe know what's normal, but if it grows up in a society that does the weirdest things, it will adapt to those conditions because that will increase your likelihood of survival, right?
Yes, in general, that's precisely right. In general, it will, under normal Darwinian conditions, it will be adaptive to do what those around you are doing, because what those around you are doing will be normal.
Yeah.
And that will be adaptive, and that's the problem. Once what those around you are doing is maladaptive and you start imitating it, then you get this contagion.
You think that's normal. You don't have a choice.
Social epistasis. And the evidence it's not normal is that doing left-wing things, being left-wing, having left-wing, a worldview that is multiculturalist, that is being vegan, that is all of these things that you associate with being left-wing, with being non-traditional, is associated with not having children. having children, fertility, which is the ultimate, the only success, really, in evolutionary. Well, there's group selection, so you can pass on the genes indirectly by, I don't know, if you were to cause a million Swedes' lives to be saved, but not have any children yourself, then you'd be doing something adaptive in evolutionary terms,
right,
as a Swede.
Okay.
But in general, the way that the measure of success in evolutionary terms is how many descendants you have, and these people that are left wing just don't have many descendants. They don't pass on their genes. What predicts passing on your genes is being religious, and independent of that, simply being politically conservative. And what's associated with being left wing is all of these markers of mutation and mental illness, schizophrenia, depression, suicidality, eating disorders, pretty much anything you can think of that's bad, that's objectively bad for your health and for your interests, is associated with being left wing. So I think that's what's happened. There's this degeneration of society, and religiousness helps as a bulwark against that, because it specifically encourages these adaptive values. It takes these values which are adaptive and which will cause the group to dominate other groups, will incentivize the individual to pass on his genes and have children because it's the will of God, will be a protector against nihilism and nihilistic attitudes, by the way, associated with being mentally ill and with not having children. It does this. So it's adaptive to the group, it's adaptive to the individual, and it reduces intelligence. But in doing so, because intelligence is weakly negatively associated with these liberal values, people who are lower in intelligence are more likely to be religious, they're more likely to be ethnocentric and whatever, then it does make you stupid, but it does mean you'll conquer the world. And this is what is happening.
Right, it is. Talk to us a little bit about, just showed a couple of headlines here, Muslim inbreeding, impacts on intelligence, sanity, health, and society. This was published primarily back on Nikolai Sennel's work. He's a Danish psychologist, back in 2010. And I remember these articles were going around too. Let me actually pull that up on the screen here. The problem of inbreeding in Islam as one of the reasons why, is supposedly this study that he did says that it leads to them being more aggressive, leads to them having lower IQ and all these kinds of things. How big of a factor is this, that the ethnocentrism is so ethnocentric that they begin doing cousin marriages and stuff like that?
Well, yes, that's and that elevates ethnocentrism, because if you look at the research by J. Philippe Rushton on genetic similarity theory, then what we are motivated by as organisms is to pass on our genes. We can pass on our genes directly by having children, but we can pass them on indirectly. And one of the ways that we do this is through assortative mating. So we tend to mate with people who are genetically relatively similar to us, mm-hmm. which increases the likelihood, it's a kind of inbreeding, of passing on our genes. So that is simply this process taken to an even greater extreme. Mm-hmm. If you think about somewhere, the kind of ecology that where Islam started, it's an ecology which is where basically it's hot. So basic needs are met to a certain extent. Basic needs are met. So there's not very strong selection in favor of intelligence. There's not very strong selection in favor of the need to cooperate with people and trust people and whatever, which is absolutely vital in a very cold and harsh ecology. You have to cooperate with people in order to achieve collective goods, or you could all just die. You won't function on your own. So in that context, how can you create an ethnocentric society? Because what positive ethnocentrism is, remember, is internal cooperation, external fighting. How do you create internal cooperation? Well, one of the ways you can reduce the gene pool. If you reduce the gene pool, then everybody is strongly related to each other, and so everybody has a genetic reason to invest in each other and to cooperate with each other. It also reduces paternity anxiety. So one of the things that causes conflict within societies is men fighting over women. You're concerned, is it really your child? You're investing in this woman and the offspring. Is it really yours? But if you're marrying your cousin anyway, then even if it's your parents and her parents are cousins, and so on. then even if you have been cuckolded, it's not really that bad, because you're investing in someone that's quite genetically similar to you.
Right.
So it elevates, it does reduce intelligence. Yes, that's a bad thing for winning the battle of group selection, but it also elevates ethnocentrism. And as long as the reduction in intelligence is the impact of that is negated by the positive of the greater ethnocentrism caused by cousin marriage, then you're fine.
But isn't this a downward spiral, though? It just gets worse and worse?
Not really, because there'll be selection every generation for intelligence. We know that. We've got data on that, even from Middle Eastern countries, from Gregory Clark or whatever. So every generation, those that are the least intelligent will die. Those that are the least intelligent will be selected out. Hmm. So they won't be able to pass on their genes, because there'll be competition within the group, and those that are more intelligent. In England, for example, it was in the 1600s, so pre-industrial conditions, the richer 50% of the population had about double the completed fertility of the poorer 50%. And there were similar numbers from non-European countries to the extent that we have data on this.
Right.
So it's not going to be a downward spiral. It's going to sustain intelligence at a certain level, and it's going to sustain ethnocentrism as well. And as long as that balance is kept right, then God Darwin doesn't care about how intelligent you are. All
right.
He cares about is that the genes survive. The winning group is the group that survives. And if that balance is correct, and in Islam it evidently is correct, because they're less intelligent than us, they're about 15 points lower IQ than Europeans, or about 10 points lower. I think in Sweden, the average IQ of Muslims is about 90 compared to a Swedish IQ of 100.
Yeah.
I think that's right. So they are less intelligent, but they are heavily outbreeding. I mean, for example, among Somalis in Finland and Sweden, the fertility is 5.
Yeah,
the average person has 5 children. And the IQ of a Somali in Finland is about 85.
Do you know if there's any evidence that it drops once they come to the West? I've heard some people argue this. Have you seen anything on that?
Well, what do you mean?
That the fertility drops.
It may drop a little bit, yes, because they're under less pressure and there's abundance around you. And so what that tells you is you don't need to just have lots of children, hope some survive. You can reduce your fertility.
Right.
But it's still higher because they're religious, and religiousness is the major predictor of fertility is religiousness. Mm-hmm. And even among white people, the major predictor of fertility is religiousness. But these people are more religious, and so, of course, they have considerably more children. A, because you could argue it's an environmental thing. The religion is telling them to. They're within this religious community and they get looked up to and they get status for having lots of children. And B, perhaps because being religious is the genetic norm. We've been selected to be religious under Darwinian conditions. We know that being religious correlates with fertility, which is a marker that it's a Darwinian norm. It correlates with physical health. It correlates with mental health. It correlates negatively with morbidity. You see it across cultures. It's 0.4 genetic. I mean, this tells you it's something that's been selected for under Darwinian conditions. It's the norm. They have the norm genes, and the norm thing to do is the survival thing, and that is having above replacement fertility, at least.
Yeah. So it's, the Dunning-Kruger effect is kind of part of this too, I guess, in the sense that you, as you said earlier, confidence, thinking you're the best, we're the greatest, we're the shit, we're going to take over. Because you see some of these pastors too, or imams, I guess we should call them. We've played clips many times where they're standing and talking about, like, you know, these Europeans are not breeding and have children with them and will outbreed them and stuff. These are kind of normal discussions, even on, like, you know, Middle Eastern TV and stuff like that. I don't know if you've seen some of the clips.
That's right, I have. And there was various Algerian pastors. They talk about a settlement from below. They are conquering Western countries with the wombs of their women.
Mm-hmm.
And that is precisely what they are doing. It is a conquest. It's an active conquest with all of the hallmarks of a conquest. Even this controversy over grooming young girls and whatever, what does that do? It is undermining the confidence of the men. It's more an attack on the men, I think, than the women, to say, look, we can do this to your females, to your young girls, and what are you going to do about it? What can you do about it?
Right.
Nothing. You can do nothing about it. Your authorities won't let you do anything about it. You can do nothing. It's undermining the confidence of the host society to do this to their females, and of course traumatizing the females and whatever as well.
Yeah.
So it is a very good strategy, but certainly the cousin marriage issue, first of all, is not an issue with all Muslim societies. I mean, there are Muslim societies where there's lots of cousin marriage, of course, Bangladesh or whatever, and there are Muslim societies where cousin marriage is not as big an issue. So it varies according to the Muslim society you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly would. It does reduce IQ. That's true. But it's going to also raise ethnocentrism. And the difference what was the difference now? And another interesting point is that the education system in Islamic countries reduces IQ. So I did some studies on this with some colleagues from Saudi Arabia. They call it the Simba effect, which is named after a black stork in Sudan whose coming heralds the arrival of the rainy season, where the land is fertile, and then after he leaves, the land is very arid. And that's a bit like what IQ in Muslim countries is like. So at the age of about 7 or 8, the IQ in the West is 100, and the IQ in these Middle Eastern countries is 92. By the age of 18, the IQ constant in Western countries is 100, and the IQ in these Middle Eastern Muslim countries is about 75. And then, which is what it is in Africa, and then by the time they reach 30, because they're out of the education system, and the education system is basically retarding their IQ, it's so bad, it's just indoctrination with religious ideas. And by the age of 30, the IQ in the West, again, is the constant of 100, and in Middle Eastern countries, it's 82. Wow. So the education system, an education system that is based around Islam and how Islam would tell you to be educated, literally reduces IQ. But of course, it inculcates you with all these religious ideas, all of these ethnocentric ideas. And so that's the positive side of it.
Yeah.
In Kuwait, you can see we did a study on this. You can see the fluctuation in the IQs. So they do, when Kuwait was under a liberal government, which was not particularly religious, then the education system is doing better, and the IQ of Kuwaitis relative to Western people goes up. And then when there's a change of government and the education system is influenced heavily by fundamentalists who are related to the Muslim Brotherhood and Qutb and this whole, you know, this whole radical Islam movement, then the IQ goes down. So in that sense as well, it's a very clear evidence of what's going on.
Yeah, I saw a slide here. Let me see if I can pull that up here real quick. An image about the importation of low IQ, obviously, and how many points it's dropped collectively in many European countries. I think Sweden and Germany were hit the hardest, and I think you actually mentioned Kuwait. Supposedly they have imported some people that have caused an increasing IQ. Let me show that map here real quick. Here's a national IQ points lost due to immigration. And you see the darker countries there, Sweden, Germany, and France are some of the most hit, lost 2.5.
You can look at, and there's two ways it would do that. So one way it would reduce IQ would be that the population, the composition of the population has changed. You have a lower IQ segment in the population, and this brings down the average, right?
Right. That That's would be what genetics. Happens.
Oh. That would be at the genetic level. No, but there's more to it than that.
Okay.
That would be at the genetic level. The other thing would be that you bring these people in, they have low IQ, they're put in schools with European people. The schools therefore have to reduce their standards, basically, have to appeal to the lowest common denominator. So the standard of education becomes worse. The standard of behavior at school, because IQ is associated with poor behavior and so on, will start to become worse. So teachers are spending more time dealing with poorly behaved immigrants and whatever. And so it will, at the environmental level, reduce the IQ of the natives, not at the genetic level, but at the environmental level, because it will mean that their education is now suboptimal and their environment is suboptimal. It will also increase stress, because once you get multiculturalism, you inevitably get conflict. It's inevitable. You always get it. And you
correct.
Get Putnam's research on this. You get distrust between the two communities and within the community, because then the native community sees people as being potential collaborators with the new people. And so this creates stress and conflict, and this is going to undermine efficiency, and this is going to reduce IQ as well. So there's two effects, genetic level, but also at the environmental level.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. I've seen that too. The school system has essentially collapsed in Sweden, in many parts of Sweden, especially, of course, the suburbs and these areas. And I'm just wondering how are they getting anything done in these schools? And they're not. That's the thing. Yeah. So tell us about, you have a lot of interesting chapters here. We've kind of gone through Muslims and IQ a little bit. I'm interested in religion and intelligence, how they correlate, what happens with. So let's take the West, and let's take Christianity, and if we go back 100 years, 150 years, something like that, we would have essentially, if you're correct, we would have a lower IQ, but it would be, of course, a higher ethnocentrism. We would have better confidence about ourselves because we were more religious, correct? And now that
no. Well, it depends what you mean by based on, no, 150 years ago we were more intelligent than we are now, unquestionably. And that is based on all kinds of proxies for that we have. We have reaction time.
Wasn't it better education then? Actually,
would have been worse education, because the education would have. But there's this thing called the Flynn effect, and so this idea is that there's been this noticeable rise in IQ scores across the 20th century between the 1930s and the 1990s, about 2.5 points per decade rise in IQ, and what that rise was on the non the least G-loaded parts of the IQ test. So you can divide the IQ test into numerous subtests, all of which are underpinned by this thing called G. And G is the essence of intelligence. It's highly genetic. It's about 0.8 heritable. So what was happening was that G was going down. As far as we can work out, our intelligence has been going down since the Industrial Revolution. Until the Industrial Revolution, we were under this harsh Darwinian selection for intelligence. Every generation, intelligence correlates with wealth, and we know about 0.3, and we know that there was this very strong advantage to being wealthy, to having high numbers of surviving offspring until about 1800. Between 1800 and 1900, there was no relationship between socioeconomic status and fertility. And then from 1900, there's been a negative relationship. And that has paralleled what we now know is a negative relationship between IQ and fertility. So people that have lower intelligence since 1900 have the most children. And that correlation is about 0.1. But what was happening in the education system is that in 1800, it would have just been dictates, you would have learned stuff parrot fashion. It would have been an education system, not unlike the education system in the Muslim world today. And as the society industrialized and became more scientific, it kind of caused you to think more. You were taught to think rather than list all the historical events in Sweden in the 16th century. It would be, why do you think the Kalmar Union, whatever, what's the causes of this? It's teaching you to think in an analytical way. And so even though G was going down, the genetic component of intelligence was seemingly going down, the 20% environmental component was going up. Because we're a bit this thing at the base of the intelligence pyramid. Here's G at the pinnacle, and here's the base with all these things that are weakly related to general intelligence, like riding a bike or driving a car, or thinking in an analytical way. This thinking in an analytical way was being pushed to its phenotypic maximum to such an extent that you have what you call the co-occurrence model. My colleague Michael Woodley of Manee calls it the co-occurrence model, where on the one hand, genetic intelligence is going down, on the other hand, environmental intelligence is going up, to such an extent that it overwhelms the decline, and it comes across on the IQ test as a rise, that we're getting more, a higher IQ from the 1930s when we started documenting this up until the late 1990s. And then you see that even there, even on the IQ test, the scores start to decline among native Scandinavian conscript and draft data.
Right.
And so what that means is that the phenotypic limit that could possibly be produced by this environment, this stimulating scientific environment, has been reached, and thus the underlying genetic decline is poking through even on the IQ test. So you're seeing a decline even on the, and that started happening about 1997. So now if we go back 150 years, we probably would have, if you'd given them a modern day IQ test, we probably would have had a much lower IQ than we have now, you're right, but we would have been more intelligent.
Yeah, I mean, the language-wise, it was much better with the language and words, vocabulary, yes, all that kind of stuff. But the reason why I brought it up in that context was I'm trying to take us back to a time where we were more religious, and you said that religion correlates with lower IQ generally. That's why I kind of...
That is true. Well, okay, let's go back to... Let's to avoid confusion, let's go back to... If we go back to the 16th century, or even the 15th century, then our per capita level of genius, our per capita use of difficult words, all of these markers of intelligence were lower than now. So we were probably less intelligent in, let's say, 1550 than we are now in Europe. We were literally less intelligent. So let's say 1550. So if we go back to that, then yeah, we were more religious, we were less analytical, we were more ethnocentric, we were in many ways more like the Muslims are now. What were we doing then? We were in the kind of summer of civilization. Our populations were young, overwhelmingly young, and vital and energetic and fearless and incredibly brave and self-sacrificing, and would just go into a new country and have no sense of their own safety because God was looking after them and everything was going to be all right in the end.
Right.
Those were the kind of attitudes that people had.
Yep.
They were cruel as well. Cruel and barbaric. All of these things. That's exactly what the population was like. And that's what their population is like now.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's the parallel. We were much less intelligent than we are now, but we were much more ethnocentric and much more confident in ourselves that, yes, we're not the best in the world at that time. The best in the world wasn't England. If I think about Henrikian or Elizabethan England, the dominant country in the world was Portugal, let's say, or the Netherlands. But, well, we soon toppled them. Or even you could go back even further. Perhaps even more interesting parallel is if you go back to medieval England. So our intelligence, let's say the 1200s, or 1100s, our intelligence was even lower, and we were even more religious, and we were confronted with an Islam that was rather, in some respects, I mean, it hadn't risen as high in terms of intelligence as we did in 1870 or whatever, when it was this peak, but they certainly were more civilized and more developed than we were. They were much more of a civilization in 1200, the Muslims, than we were.
And well, the kind of Islam, because of what they took over, obviously, right? What they conquered, the ancient world.
No, it's partly because of what they conquered, but they also did make, I mean, we can look at them. There are various innovations they made themselves, such as innovations in terms of understanding certain innovations in medicine and whatever. There were certain innovations they made. Even if they didn't innovate these things themselves, to be able to sustain brilliant innovations that other people made requires a certain degree of intelligence. I mean, you could argue that people in sub-Saharan Africa took over, people in, let's say, Zimbabwe, took over this Rhodesia that was created by white men. They didn't innovate anything there, but they couldn't even sustain it.
Mm-hmm.
They just went backwards.
Right.
Muslims at least had the intelligence to be able to sustain it. Anyway, they were the ones that were had this very fundamentalist form of religiousness in the early Islam and whatever. And then by this time, the 1000s, 1100s, they were liberal again. They were liberal and they weren't. And that is when we managed to displace them. And it was round about that time when they were displaced that you had these, what was that theologian's name? Al-Ghazali, that's his name. Al-Ghazali, he lived 1058 to 1111. And in many ways, you could argue he's kind of a proto-fundamentalist figure. And he was arguing, oh, no, we need to return to the original Islam, what it was like in the early Islam, when we were powerful and important and weren't being invaded by these Europeans. And then you had a similar kind of movement in Saudi Arabia. Al-Wahhab.
Wahhabism,
In the early 1700s. And it's again this idea that we're being destroyed by this foreign power. And if we return to the early church, as it were, kind of almost like people say Islam's never had a reformation. People go on about it's never had a reformation. I say it has.
It has, right?
I had a number of reformations. I say that what Luther was about returning Christianity to really, it was taking Christianity that was quite liberal in a lot of ways. I mean, people forget that in the 1200s in Europe, homosexuality was tolerated. Prostitution was not just tolerated. I mean, prostitutes would go to church in Rome and take mass, and they would happily get. They were very assiduous churchgoers because they could use going to church as a means of advertising to the community. Witchcraft was tolerated. It was barely even a crime. It was a liberal regime. It was liberal, and it combined certain aspects of church with sort of paganism. And it was liberal attitudes to nudity, liberal attitudes to use of prostitution, whatever, all liberal. And it was Luther and Calvin that reversed this and tried to go back to what they saw as the early church and to this fundamentalist movement. And it could be argued that it was on the back of that that the Western ascent into power over the world on the back of that fervor occurred to some extent, and that's what's happening in Islam now. I think that's what was going on with them, and it's what was happening most recently, of course, with Sayyid Qutb, who was the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, and around whom a lot of radical Islam is basically based.
Fascinating. Now the religion question then it's pretty interesting because we need. Just, I don't know if I'm cutting ahead here by going to like solutions, but we can dive back into some of the details later. But we're obviously wondering how do we fix this? What do we do, right? And so religiosity is a big component to that. People have to have some kind of spiritual life. They have to have a belief, or as you said, and I've said this for years without kind of knowing the studies. Like, if you have a people who like not only thinks they sincerely believe that God is on their side. In other words, whatever we do is correct. And if we succeed, that's proof that God granted us, victory, that we were correct and it was proven right. We are so far removed from that today that we doubt everything, uncertainty, maybe some other culture have the answer, some other people have the answer, surely we can't, it's self-hating, self-loathing, everything. But it seems impossible to go from, let's say, a scientific stance that we have now, and it doesn't mean that doesn't mean rational, by the way. There's a lot of irrational things that goes on in our society, obviously, but to go from that state back into a religious state, that have you looked at that? Does that happen historically?
Yes.
Maybe throughout when there's great hardship or something, or
yes, precisely. So there tends to be a movement of civilizations in cycles, and what inevitably happens is that as the civilization, there is strong selection for intelligence. As the civilization becomes more intelligent, its standards of living go up, levels of stress go down, people become less religious for that reason. Also, as you become more intelligent, intelligence is associated with openness and with a kind of questioning disposition. And so you start the same questioning disposition, which makes you pro-science, also concomitantly makes you question religiousness. And what I've suggested in my book, Adolf Wittgenstein, Why We're Becoming Less Intelligent and What It Means for the Future, is that the brilliance of Western civilization was that our taboo on like heresy, basically, on questioning things, was so extreme that it meant that we got really, really, really far, further than had previously been got, before we started questioning religiousness. We got past the Industrial Revolution and then started questioning religiousness heavily, whereas other societies started questioning religiousness and whatever before they got there, because they and also started using contraception. That's the other thing. Again, we didn't start using contraception because there was such a taboo on it, which we'd inherited from the Jews, until we got past the Industrial Revolution. Other societies, such as Islamic society, they tend to start using contraception or whatever at an earlier stage. Even in Rome, in Greece, it's documented that you get to a relatively high level of civilization, of comfort, and then the people at the top of society, for some reason, just stop having children. And the people at the top of society are the most intelligent people. And so inevitably, then intelligence starts to decline, and it always happens. And those people who are at the top of society, they also start questioning the society's religiousness. They start adopting these liberal values, they start being pro-abroad. For example, during the decline of Rome, you see them being in favor of the mystery cults and things from the East and whatever, and inviting the non-Romans, the barbarians, into the society, inviting people from the East into the society. And so there's this, of course, means that ethnocentrism starts to break down for reasons we discussed earlier, because there's this distrust that's sown. And so they're not ethnocentric anymore. They're declining in intelligence. They don't have this sense of their own importance because they're not religious anymore. That gets undermined. So their sense of their own importance starts to be undermined. And then they are confronted with the enemy at the gate, whether it's the Germans or whoever it happens to be, or the Romans in the case of the Greeks, who are ethnocentric and who are religious and who do have a sense of their own importance, and then they get invaded, and then the society collapses into war and chaos and whatever. And that tends to be what happens again and again and again, cyclically, throughout the history of Europe, throughout the history of Asia, throughout the history of China, everywhere you get these movements. And so I suspect what's going to happen, and I think it's probably already happening, there will be more religiousness for a number of reasons. Firstly, because we are being invaded, this will cause war. War causes stress. Stress causes people to become more religious.
Yeah.
Secondly, there's ethnic conflict inevitably. And when you have two ethnic groups that come together, this will cause stress, this will cause war, this will elevate religiousness. And thirdly, the people who, at the genetic level, the people who are more religious are having more children. And there is quite a high heritability to religiousness. And the people who are more conservative are having more children. And there's quite a high heritability of about 0.4 or around that to this. Now, this growing religiousness and growing ethnocentrism is held back by the high standards of living that we are able to maintain. But because intelligence is declining, then eventually we will come to a point where more and more things will go wrong. Society will become more and more stressful. We won't be able to sustain the high standard of living. To a certain degree, then we're going to start to see death. We're going to start to see people who have problems, not be able to get hospital treatment. This will cause more religiousness, more ethnocentrism. This is what I would predict would happen. And interestingly, it will be the left that will bear the brunt of this, because as I discussed earlier, being left-wing is associated with mental and physical illness. So it's the left whose policies will kill them when this reverses, it will be the normal, genetically normal people like me and you that will survive. But I think it's a matter of time. And based on current trends, 100 years hence, we will be back at the level of per capita innovation that we were at in 1100. So we were at a peak in 1870 of per capita genius, basically per capita major innovations per million of population per year. We're now back at the level we were in 1600. So, you know, when Elizabeth I was on the throne, and we will, it's the dramatic collapse. So we will be 1100 medieval times. 100 years or so hence. And so what I would predict is there will be just an inevitable movement back towards religiousness.
Will we see that, though? Because, of course, in the past, we didn't have computers, we didn't have the modern lifestyle, things that could help and aid us in that situation. Today, we have things that would make up for that. What I'm saying is that maybe the collapse wouldn't be... Eventually, I think we'll reach there. So don't get me wrong. But I think at least it won't be as visible and as dramatic as that. Like we fall off the cliff.
I would agree with you. Oh, yeah, that's quite right. We won't be going back 100 years hence to what the standard of living was in 1100. No way. Right. But we may perhaps be going back to what the standard of living was 70 years ago or 80 years ago, something like that. We may find that we can't sustain things like the internet. We already can't sustain Concorde. I mean, that seems fairly clear. We can't get Concorde back into the air, which is stupid. There's too many little
mistakes. Can't go to the moon. What happened?
Can't go to the moon, can't go to Concorde, and I don't know why they even bother wasting breath talking about this Mars nonsense. You can forget that.
Right.
So many people would die
Elon
if it
will
did
fix, so, Musk will fix it for us, don't worry.
Will he? So I think there will be that movement backwards. The other thing to mention, of course, is that there is, of course, a religiosity. There's two kinds of, we can perhaps talk about two kinds of religiosity. Mm-hmm. One is the adaptive religiosity that's associated with passing on your genes and whatever, and that's adaptive in a Darwinian sense. And then there's this maladaptive, and it is a kind of religiosity, really, of multiculturalism, of kind of moral realism, where you take certain disembodied concepts. You have a vague sense of fate, perhaps, but you take certain concepts like equality and you kind of reify them and you worship those. And what you see now is really a kind of church of multiculturalism among the intellectual classes in the West. And you have to belong to, or at least pay lip service to this church, increasingly in order to, well, be able to use YouTube. Look at that band video there, Angela Saini, in order to be able to use YouTube, in order to be able to be a university lecturer, in order to be able to do anything for the state. This is the state cult, and it's a maladaptive cult which has a death wish as its central goal. It essentially wants to destroy the genetic interests of those, i.e. European people, who are its members. It encourages them to have abortions. It encourages them to have abortions specifically if the baby inside them is European rather than mixed race. It encourages them to not breed for the sake of humanity and for the sake of the world and the environment and whatever. It encourages them to destroy themselves. So that is a kind of religion, but it's a maladaptive religion as opposed to an adaptive one.
Right.
And it's the adaptive one that will win out in Darwinian terms, because these maladaptive people, although they are wrecking society in the short term and damaging everything accordingly, they are so maladaptive that they just don't want to breed, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a brilliant thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've talked about this last time, but it's such an interesting discussion to have that about that cyclical nature, that just reflecting on that issue too, that it is due to our success, right? Material success that we ended up in this situation. And as you said, the elites, the upper class, they get lazy and complacent. There's even Tolkien had this great line in one of the movies, or in the books, I should say, but it's reiterated in the third movie when Gandalf goes up to, I forget what it was called, but the white tree is there. It's dead, the tree, kind of indicative of civilization. He says this, the rulers, their hall stood empty and they stopped having children. And, you know, it was like a reflection that he was aware of this. And obviously there was kind of the undertone was, this is what's happening to the West right now. Most of the leaders, they don't have kids, right? There's no genetic investment in our future, essentially.
And then the further, that's true, they don't have children, there's no investment in the future. And so you just end up with this nihilistic philosophy of living for the now, of drink, eat, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall die.
Right.
And if you're up against a society like Islam that doesn't have that, that has, we won't die tomorrow, we're going to live forever, then they have God on their side, then they can destroy. And then with the immigration issue as well, if you look at you've got my BitChute thing up on the screen there. Now you've got the video there about Angela Saini. What is she? She's a Hindu living in Britain. So what's in her genetic interest as an Indian is to undermine the ethnocentrism of the native population, of English people. And we
see that a lot, actually, by people in like public positions, both in England and Sweden and stuff. They're vocally out in the open advocating for like the displacement of us, essentially, and the things that would benefit them.
She doesn't openly advocate for the displacement of Europeans, but what she does try and undermine is the concept of race and ethnicity and the idea that the English are their own ethnic group with their own ethnic interests, and she tries to argue that we're all the same. And she does this while writing other books. Well, she wrote a book called Geek Nation, in which she implies that Indians are like genetically good at science. So you can see her tactic is an ethnic war in which she tries to undermine the interests of those that have taken her in through her work. Another video that you saw there was of John Burko and his wife, Sally Burko, née Ilman, John Bercow certainly is Jewish. I think Sally Ilman might be Jewish. And again, you can see from a Jewish perspective, there could be an idea. This is Kevin McDonald's model, of course, that it would be in your interest to avoid there being nationalism among the host population and act in that way. And so, but you can see it more obviously with Angela Saini. It's very conspicuous that that's what she's doing. So yeah, all of these things come together to, oh, I can't even bear to look at her.
I just realized this now. We covered this in a Weekend Warrior show. She wrote one book. I think it was, I forget which order it was, but the first was Inferior and then it was Superior, right? It was all about
Inferior is about how there aren't sex differences, except of course there are.
Ah.
And Superior is about how there aren't race differences, except of course there are. She actually mentions me by name in Superior, which I found particularly
interesting. Really? Interesting.
I was able to trace the kind of, she gets incredible mistakes. So she gets the name of Darwin's first book wrong, for example. Dawkins said in this thing where he had debased himself today towards Big Sister Angela Saini, Big Sister is watching you. Oh, you've said that eugenics is possible, which of course it is. Of course it is. It's possible among animals if we are animals, and it's possible among us.
Here's the tweet here.
He said, "Oh, I've read her book, and it's, well, I don't know if that's the tweet, but that's his original tweet. Yeah,
that's the first
he
one,
said
yeah.
that I've read Angela D. Saini's book, and it's well researched. He couldn't have read it if he thinks it's well researched. For someone to get the name of Darwin's first book wrong, to think it's Descent of Man rather than Origin of Species, is not an example of well researched. Another thing she did was she had a go at Mankind Quarterly Journal, and then cited as a source of factual information an article by me written in Mankind Quarterly." So, I mean, it just came across as an utterly, not just a mendacious piece of work and a piece of work that was ideologically driven and not interested at all in the facts, but a piece of work which was just sloppy person.
Yeah, this is what it is now, but it's promoted, it's put center stage in our society. These are now experts that they go to tell us about race and discrimination and all these kinds of things. And
she's an incredible, so she asked Nathan Kofness, who's a colleague of mine who's Jewish, who researches race differences and whatever and does some very interesting research on them, and she asked him to go on her radio show or something about racism, and he refused to do so because he said, I don't think I'd get a fair hearing. And then on Twitter, he noted that even though they'd never corresponded on Twitter, she had blocked him, even though they'd never corresponded. And she's got this block list of everybody that might not be multiculturalist, because apparently it's a danger to her mental health for someone to disagree with her.
That's right. Yeah, that's like a true scientist.
True scientist, like an Adam Rutherford.
No. Let me see. I think, I think we were blocked there. Let me just click in on her Twitter real quick here and see.
Big Sister will watch you, but you're blocked. If you don't worship Big Sister slavishly and unquestionably, then Big Sister will block you, and she
That's
is
right.
Big Sister.
That's
Angela
right.
Saini is watching you. If you're Richard Dawkins, and she's got this group of unhinged followers, it's very dangerous.
She has it here though in the banner here. Nature top 10 books of 2019. Financial Times Book of the Year. Sunday Times Book of the Year. Guardian Book of the Year. Telegraph top 50 books of 2019. New Statesman Book of the Year.
She's an utter braggart, and I don't know if you can see her summary of herself, her Twitter bio.
I guess I'm forbidden. It's verboten for me to look at that.
One of the things that she writes is Oxford alumna. Now, how many people do you know on Twitter that boast in their Twitter bio about the university they went to 25 years ago? Not many. she's an unbelievable braggart. She comes across in the video as all, oh, hello, I'm Angela Saini. I speak English with a slight Indian accent. This is a dangerous woman, dangerous to science and dangerous to civilization.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, well, that's what we're getting, right? And again, these are the people that will continue to undermine confidence in our society, in ourselves, why we should become more ethnocentric, why that's healthy, why every group is ethnocentric. This is completely understandable. But again, as you said...
But it's okay for the Indians. The Indians, it's okay.
Absolutely.
Although she does a section in Superior, where she critiques the caste system. She has done another book, the separate book, Geek Nation, where she argues that Indians are basically inherently superior at technical things. Which, by the way, may well be true, in the sense that, okay, their average IQ is lower than the European average IQ, but because there's a billion people in India, you do get a large raw number of people that have very high IQ, and Indians are very high in conscientiousness. They're higher in conscientiousness than Europeans. And the thing that predicts being good at science is that you have very high intelligence plus very high conscientiousness, i.e. impulse control, finishing tasks and whatever. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if you should find that Indians are overrepresented.
Sure.
Among she's changed her. Oh yeah, look, Oxford alumna. There you go.
Yeah,
Oxford engineer. She's changed. Oxford engineer.
Engineer. Yeah.
She has an engineering degree, which is interesting because you'd expect someone that has an engineering degree to be rigorously logical, and the fact that she's not implies all kinds of personality
political
issues for her.
That's what it is. Illogical. But yeah, as you said,
as you say, she knows that she's wrong, and she's just saying it for political reasons. Yes.
Right. Yeah. I don't know which one it is, but regardless, the way also is that, well, she's seen that she's part of a victim group, a victim class, which of course kind of that gives them or her group or whatever group she's promoting. It gives her in other words, it's okay to make sure that they are uplifted and feel, well, actually, we actually are better at something, or we are this XYZ group, and we can do things better than these whites. It feels like it's just an anti-white narrative. That's simply what it is. It's to put down people of European descent, and they will lift up whoever they have to in order to kind of make sure that we feel shoved down with our faces into the dirt, essentially.
Yeah, I know. And remember, she's from the Punjab. Her parents are from the Punjab. They came to England in the 70s or late 60s. And so they have been under Darwinian selection for longer. They are more likely to be adapted to winning the evolutionary battle. And they come to somewhere like Britain, where they can further win the evolutionary battle by undermining the confidence and the sense of nationalism of the native population. And because the native population have among them these spiteful mutants, these cuckoos among them, these spiteful mutants who are actively undermining, who are encouraging them to do maladaptive things, these spiteful mutants who have themselves a genetic death wish, who'd never have survived under normal Darwinian conditions, but who have survived, who are able to reach the top of society because, of course, Darwinian conditions broke down among the upper classes first, and the heritability of social class is quite high, it's about 0.7, so therefore you're going to get more of these spiteful mutants among the upper classes directing the society in a maladaptive direction, and they are happy to collaborate with these foreigners for the interests of the foreigners against them.
And then you get Antifa flag background there, by the way?
It's an appropriate background. Very, very appropriate.
I think it is, anyway.
Anti-freedom of expression. Very, very anti-science. Very, very appropriate.
That's right. And it's all like racism. I see that too. Look at her Twitter thread. That's all it is. Racism. Of course, as we said, and I'm trying to get to that point too, that we're reaching a tipping point now where people are beginning to just not give a crap about this stuff. They are fed up with having these messages shoved down their throats. They know that they have to start taking their own side, or we and our children are going to suffer immensely. I think we're seeing kind of a slight turn in Sweden right now. There's a lot of people that are just sick and fed up with this waves of immigrants and open borders. They are seeking themselves towards the Sweden Democrats. It becomes more and more common to discuss these things, whereas just 10, even 5 years ago, it was taboo to address these topics. And it's finally now happening, a shift where even mainstream media are beginning to address the problems of migration and what do we do and Islam, and they're talking about these things. So I feel that we are close, and those countries that are further down the line of ruin are the ones that are going to go into that direction quicker. What do you feel about the timeline of how this is going to play out? Because as you said before, all these things, I think, are inevitable. This is the direction where things are going to go.
Yes, it is inevitable. There's a tipping point of about 25%, as I said, 20-25%. I don't know if that's a tipping point of those that vote or those that of the society as a whole. If it's those that vote, then in Finland we seem to be at that tipping point of 25%. 25% of people or something along those lines would vote for True Finns if there was an election tomorrow.
Yeah.
And even True Finns have a cuck element to them, which is they try and distance themselves from ethno-nationalists, overt ethno-nationalists. But so I would think a country like Finland, as I predicted in my book, The Silent Rape Epidemic, is the best place to be ripped apart by multiculturalism, but the best place to respond because of the fact that they're so conformist that if the scales tip, then they will all rush onto the new dispensation very, very quickly. So, and this, as I said, there's going to be a finished translation of that out in the beginning of April. So we are, I don't know, I don't want to make predictions about these kinds of things. It's not something I'm good at doing. I have various colleagues, Andrew Sabisky and Michael something or other, who are super forecasters, and they make predictions as a serious business, but it's not But I do. I am quietly confident that we're moving in this direction. And you get these, as I believe the term is, black-pilled type people who are black-pilled about Brexit or whatever. But I think that Brexit and then Donald Trump and then the fact that in Britain the Parliament kind of, that was this anti-Brexit Parliament, this Parliament of traitors, eventually they just sort of lost the will. They just sort of on some level realised that the tide was moving against them and they just kind of gave up. And then there was an election in which the Labour Party were substantially crushed. And I'm really, really hoping that there's an election in the Labour Party for the new leader, and there's these two airhead women who are standing to be the new leader. One of them's called Lisa Nandy, the other one's called Rebecca Long Bailey. And I hope one of them, particularly Lisa Nandy, wins, because it will be the further destruction of the forces of evil in my country. But yes, I think it's the change is definitely happening. I mean, I was thinking that even certainly 10 or 15 years ago, I would never have thought like this or be having conversations like this. That was the margins of the margins that were thinking in this kind of way 20 years ago. We had this magazine in the UK Right Now. It had a circulation of a few thousand. And there was a controversy in 2001. Yeah, it's Long Bailey or Nandy that we want to win. Nandy particularly, because she seems to have the brain of a the brain the size of a crisp. I mean, you don't advocate republicanism in Britain. That's taboo. People say, oh, there's lots of left-wing taboos. There aren't any right-wing taboos. There is. There's one right-wing taboo, and that's the monarchy. You don't question the monarchy. That's the right-wing taboo. Don't question it, ever. And she has publicly done that. There should be a referendum on the monarchy, and I'd vote for a republic. So
interesting.
If she becomes leader, I so hope she becomes leader. And she's half Indian, by the way, as well. So
I thought that was something going on there.
But yes. So I don't know exactly when it will happen, but I do think it's within the next 10 years. This guy Peter Turkin, this Russian researcher, he argues, done some very interesting research on this, where he looks quantitatively at these cycles of wealth and poverty, basically, and what happens in these cycles, such as that when things are falling apart, you have in the period of wealth, you have all these people vying for status and who think they can get status and they can't. And so you have an overpromoted society. There's not enough elite positions for them to fill. This leads to intra-elite competition to gain these positions, which is what we see. There's this breakdown in the elite, which leads to polarization as people try and find a niche to make their way into the elite. Let's say the 600 places in Parliament or whatever it happens to be. And so you get more and more polarization. And then they realize the society is polarized. Also, you get polarization of wealth. And then they realize the society is polarized and they try to do things about it by bringing wealth levels closer together and by reducing overpromotion and all this kind of thing. And the cycle just carries on like this. And he tracks through history the way this has happened. It seems to perhaps quite to parallel to some extent the rise and fall of civilizations in an extreme form. And he argues that we are currently, as America is currently, as polarized based on various measures as it was at the dawn of the Civil War. And he predicts that the 2020s are going to be a period of unparalleled violence and fighting.
Right.
Because if you think what it was like 20 years ago, politics in America was bunched at the center and there was hardly any difference between the Democrats and the Republicans and everyone trusted each other. And think what it's like now.
Right.
And they hate each other. So if he's right, then perhaps by the end of the 2020s, things will have very comprehensively changed in terms of attitudes.
Now, if we talk specifically about Islam here, I don't know if you're going to it in the book. I haven't gone through all of it yet, but is there any part where you write about what we need to do, what we should do? How do we tackle this as a threat?
I said we have to become. I do at the end of the book. So I go through all these different aspects of Islam, which reduce intelligence, but which raise ethnocentrism. So cousin marriage is of course a big one, and I look at all of the five pillars of Islam and how each of those involves basically reduce your faith, you less logic, less critical thinking, prayer. Less logic, less critical thinking, waking up in the middle of the night, being tired in the day, less industry, society working less well industrially, people not doing well as efficiently, society being poorer, therefore the education system being worse, therefore intelligence is brought down, therefore stress is higher, therefore religiousness is higher. And you can look at all of these aspects of Islam, and almost all of them create the same thing. Fasting, what does it do? It interferes with the running of the economy. It interferes with industry. It makes people, literally reduces IQ. If you're hungry and you haven't got enough, your IQ will start to reduce. So you're less logical in your thinking. Women will fast when they're pregnant, which results in retard.
I'm sorry, let me just back up to that point a little bit. Isn't that just kind of a... The fasting thing, Ed, before you continue, it's interesting. I just want to ask you about that. Yeah. There's some of the in the Muslim world now, they actually end up gaining weight at the month of Ramadan because they, of course, eat copious amounts of sweets after sundown. You remember that?
Well, yes. So I haven't heard about that, but that would be an interesting side. But of course, the positive side of the fasting, of course, is that it's a monitoring issue. Not only does it reduce intelligence, perhaps, but it's a monitoring issue. You can monitor people if you do things like that. You can see that they're committed. And this elevates ethnocentrism because it helps you to push out the free rider, push out the person who's not really religious, not really committed. The same with Hajj, the same with all of these different kinds of things, the same with regular prayer. And so it's a really brilliant system in a sense. And so what I set out writing it, and I didn't realize I was going to come away from writing the book with such a kind of grudging respect for Islam or indeed the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
It's control. That's what you're saying. It's a system of control, ultimately.
It's a system of control, yeah, which ensures that those who keep to it, if they deviate from it, as they did in the medieval era, then they're in trouble. But if they keep to it, then they will dominate other groups. It's almost like a manifesto of group selection, of making sure that your group dominates. Mm. And what I look at in the last chapter, you ask, what can we do? We almost did. There is I'm not sure how historically accurate there is, but there's a non-contemporary source, so a source writing about 100 years after the event, who argued that King John, so you know Robin Hood, have you heard of Robin Hood?
Mm-hmm.
It's a legend in the UK.
Yeah.
And so there was a period between 1189 and 1199 when the king was Richard I, Richard the Lionheart. He was away fighting in the Holy Lands, fighting the Crusade. And so the country was ruled by his younger brother, King John, subsequently King John, John Lackland, who was king 1199 to 1216 or 17, I think it was. And King John was an appalling king, and he ruled the country very, very badly. And there was a point where he was so bankrupt that he said that he sent emissaries to the one of these emirs, I forget which, it might have been the emir of Morocco, and said, look, if you bail me out, I'll make my people Muslim. What do you reckon?
Is that true?
Well, that's what the source, it's not an unreliable source, but it's not a contemporary source.
Right.
100 years after the event. And the emirs got the impression that this king was such an appalling tyrant that he just said, no, I'm not interested in doing business with this person. He's terrible. And so we could have become Muslim. So basically, I think we have to become more like Islam. That's what we have to do. We have to be more like those who are conquering us. It seems to be quite a basic thing.
Interesting.
And nationalists are more like them. And that means returning to traditional ideas.
So why Sharia? That's your proponent.
White Sharia.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that's a nice term for it. Or let's give it a kind of English Western thing and call it something like King John's Wager or something like that. So it's got some sort of grounding in our history.
Now, one thing I tried to get to a little bit earlier, it's the issue of faith. And I know that this is about, you know, Islam means submission. It's about control. We talked about all those things, of course, which might or might not be welcomed in a, if it's dire times, yeah, it might be welcome, as it has been in past European history too. We've had, of course, systems of authoritarianism that has come in at times of great upheaval and panic, essentially, to restore some kind of level of order, right? When things just go out of bounds. But with the faith aspect, that's not something you can enforce, right? You can't make people have faith in a higher being or something or a system which is above our own. That's impossible, right? Well, what's your thoughts on that?
I'm not 100% sure about that. There's research by Kevin MacDonald who talks about what's called effortful control, and this is that we have the capacity, and the more intelligent we are, the more we have this capacity to force ourselves essentially to believe things are true, even if they're not, if it's in our interests to do so. And similarly, in much the same way that we have these spiteful mutants that are now influencing women to postpone pregnancy till they can't have children, or to have abortions when they don't need to, or to whatever it happens to be, these spiteful mutants, these witches that are basically influencing women to be highly maladaptive, in much the same way, if the people that were in positions of influence in the society were influencing them to be adaptive and to behave adaptively, including to be religious. I wouldn't be at all surprised if there would be some kind of domino effect, because human beings are naturally inclined, most of them, to be pack animals that do what those in positions of power are doing. Not just what they tell them to, but to literally imitate them. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if the situation... That's why, I mean, we've had in the history of the West, even as we've declined, we've had revivals. So you've had periods of time where people are getting more and more atheistic, and then religiousness goes up. Now, one of those was World War II. So church attendance in England was declining, and then World War II starts to go up, and in the wake of World War II as well, because, I don't know, some kind of delayed trauma or delayed stress or something, people are more religious. But equally, you had in the 50s people like Billy Graham, the American evangelist, coming in, and people who weren't particularly religious suddenly having dramatic religious experiences and saying, I'm Christian. So there are environmental elements. Religion is 40% heritable, which means that 60% of it is a matter of environment and what's going on in the environment. So there are stress is one environmental factor. Feeling you're excluded is another environmental factor. And simply things like who you come under the spell of is an environmental factor. So I don't think it's necessarily as difficult as you make out. When I was at university in Durham, I actually did my field work on this. It was called Meeting Jesus at University. And I looked at whether these various atheists all turn up at university, and by the end of the time, they're Christian. Because the university was this sort of place which questioned their sense of self and their sense of structure and their sense of who they are, which left them crying out for a sense of identity, and the Christian fundamentalists were there to give it to them. So I'm not sure it's quite as difficult as you say.
Interesting. Yeah, but maybe I'm overthinking it, and maybe the masses aren't on that level where they're philosophers and overthinking things. And they did. I mean, generally, most people are followers, right? And if they have enough people. In some sphere of society that becomes promoted or interesting or becomes popular or something, people tend to mimic, right? They tend to follow those leaders.
The interesting thing about that is look at the flipping females. So if you've looked at Jim Goad's very funny book, The New Church Ladies, mm-hmm. and women are more religious than men for personality reasons. Religion is associated with empathy, and so women are more empathetic than men, and so women are more religious than men. Now, until the 1960s or 70s, women were more right in Western countries. Women were more right-wing than men. They were more politically conservative than men because they were more religious than men, and the religiousness was a traditionalist form of religiousness that was telling them to do traditional things, and that made them more conservative. Then the religiousness broke down, collapsed in influence over them, and also became taken over by these spiteful mutants and became left-wing and became basically multiculturalism in a mitre of the kind that you see in Sweden with this crazy bitch that's in charge of the Church of Sweden. And so then, of course, women become more left-wing.
Yes.
Men.
Yeah.
As is the current situation with the protection of religiousness taken away, and perhaps with the protection of patriarchy taken away as well. Perhaps women are evolved to patriarchy. They're evolved to be told what to do by men. And so in the absence of these protections, then of course they become their natural propensity to super empathy to everybody and low ethnocentrism comes out. And so I think that's the flip then, that the church ladies used to be these very, very conservative people, the most traditionalist people in society, and now the church ladies are the wokest, most left-wing people in society.
Right. And we argued this last time, Ed, but it's a new form of, it's another version of a religion. It's something irrational which they have adopted, and they're clinging onto that, and they become the most vehement... they're like the Inquisition. We have an Inquisition now of these bands of people roaming online, and they're if you say the wrong things, if you think the wrong things, if you publish or write wrong things, they're all over you, and they will report you. They will make sure that you're banned and censored. Right? That it's women primarily driven then.
Precisely. Now, this woman, Angela Saini, is not really an example of that, because she's, I would argue, just an ethnic activist for Indians. But there are people surrounding her. There's one called Jess Wade, who's a scientist in London. At Imperial College London, they're exactly like that, and they go around trying to find stuff that offends them to report and get it shut down. They are the church ladies, but those people would probably if you went back to the 1500s, they'd have been the first to have you burned at the stake for questioning
That's
the traditional
right.
way of doing things.
Absolutely, I saw you tweeted about Becca Lewis, right? All the alternative influence network, the data and society crowd, the censorship, major censorship people online. The was a young girl in the UK. I think she's half Jewish, half Asian. No, actually, she was in the US. She wrote for the UK paper, The Guardian, though. She got us banned off of Facebook, for example, right? I think majority of these are women. Yeah.
I didn't know who she was. I was just going through stupid things that people have written about Andrew Sabisky, and I saw her, and I just wrote no way.
Oh, yeah. They're getting literally, she's literally getting George Soros money to sit and monitor people who should be censored all day. She's working for Data and Society, which is this organization, again, that's funded by George Soros, New York Times, the Ford Foundation, all these big names, right? They're the ones who released the Alternative Influence Report back in 2017, was it? Which was kind of, it led to the foundation of how YouTube started dealing with their algorithm, how they changed and update their terms of service and all that stuff. It's three women, Joan Donovan, Becca Lewis, and the third one, which I forget the name of now. I didn't know that.
I just thought she was just some nobody that came up on my Twitter feed. She's actually one of the most evil people in the universe.
Well, there you go. She's a pro-censorship activist, essentially, to boil it down in its most simplest form.
And is she a childless spinster?
Probably. I don't know personally.
That consistent, because that's what the church ladies were, remember? They were these embittered spinsters.
Yeah, I'm sure she is, you know, to be honest. She was very happy to reveal that she was Jewish to me because I tweeted about her and she's just said, I know you want to say it. Why don't you just say that I'm a Jew or something? And I was like, I didn't even know you were Jewish. I guess it's at the forefront of your mind. Here they are. Look at her. Here.
It never occurred to me she was Jewish. I just thought she was a nasty, unpleasant person. whatever race she was. I just thought she was a spiteful mutant, you know.
She's a mutant, all right. She's a mutant,
evil.
All right.
Well, yeah, that one on the there's at least two mutants there. I'm not sure that the one on the
So this is the front cover of the video I did on this. The women behind the Alternative Influence Network report, which
that one at the top though. That one, she was born a man though, yeah.
I don't know. I don't think so, but maybe you never know.
I would think so.
Joan Donovan, Becca Lewis, and I forget the third woman at the bottom.
That correlates with all kinds of mental problems, with depression, schizophrenia, all kinds of anything physical and mentally wrong that you can almost think of being transsexual. Strong, high mutation, very high mutational load.
Yeah, exactly. No, definitely. No, these are, what I'm saying is you just haven't stumbled over someone who just happened to be critical. This is a network of people
I've stumbled across a coven.
That's right, exactly. A coven of girls and women who want to deplatform voices that they don't like to make sure that our society continues its decline towards ruin, I guess. I don't know what the goal is with these women, but yeah.
That is the goal. Yeah, just they are focused on the destruction of themselves, their own genetic interests at least, and of the whole society. Yeah, like Andrea Dworkin.
Also comes this, like, if I can't have it, no one will. It's this, like, kind of spitefulness. Like, I will ruin everything, right?
Yes, that is consistent with what they're saying. But I see you keep putting her on the screen, but I think she's a different thing. Even if looking at her, she's not mutant, is she? She's reasonably symmetrical face, reasonably pretty. She's not. She is a. If anything, you could argue that she's well adapted to pursuing the interests of her ethnic group, which is Punjabi people.
Yeah.
And that's what she's doing very successfully by undermining the nationalism of European people.
Yeah, I think they know. I think a lot of those kinds of activists, they definitely know. They want to utilize their position and they ride the wave of this anti-ethnocentrism when it comes to Europeans to promote their own interests. Again, is this at the forefront of her? How aware of this is she? She might be, but she might also not be. But she's definitely she's using that position and using the time that we're in right now to make sure that we continue our decline. That's what I think.
Yes, I think that's entirely correct. But I think it's a slight nuance, which is that both her and that black lady that she's talking to are acting in the interests of their own race positively, whereas a lot of these white people are acting to destroy themselves.
Yeah.
It's a slightly different thing. She has written stuff undermining the caste system, and from a evolutionary perspective, the caste system is really, frankly, a quite fantastic thing. Mm-hmm. And it's a very well thought out system to ensure that the most intelligent end up with the most children. So there's polygamy at the top. The highest caste men who are likely most intelligent, they can have polygamy, but there's no polygamy at the bottom. So to be a good Hindu, if you're at the bottom of the Shudra, you can't marry down into the Dalit, then you're a bad Hindu. You just don't marry.
Interesting.
You just don't pass on your genes. But if you're at the top, and you're a woman and you can't marry down under their system, if you're a woman, you can marry up to a highest of high Brahmin and then in a polygamous marriage. So it's a eugenic system.
Overall, or does she? Do you know if she criticizes like Modi and the current regime in India? Because they're, of course, they're very conservative now, aren't they? Right.
As far as they are very much so. I don't recall her. I've got the book here. I don't recall her.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, so that's superior
that's superior. I don't recall her. I don't know if the word superior senses to her own sense of superiority and smugness. I don't recall her mentioning Modi. I'm looking at the index. No, she doesn't mention it. She just interviews an academic about the caste system. And he tries to argue, an Indian academic, that the caste system. And she does, that's another thing, in terms of her own interests. She doesn't like, that's it, yes, she doesn't like the caste system because she's half Hindu and half Sikh. And she gives the impression, and I mentioned this in my video review of her book, that's been a problem in her family. There's been some kind of rift because a Sikh married a Hindu. So she has a problem with Hinduism in that sense. Her father's a Sikh, I think it was, and her mother's a Hindu. And so, she's against even that. She's against even the Hindus. I don't know what she's trying to promote. She's kind of not sure who she is. Perhaps that's why she's so conflicted. She can't be a Sikh. She can't be quite a Hindu, she can't quite be anything.
Isn't that quite common, actually, if we look at the West too, that a lot of people that are mixed, or they have a mixed background or whatever, they in many regards have become activists for destroying the whole thing, right? Essentially because they have an internal conflict, essentially, or they can't pick a side, then no one should have it, right? Destroy ethno, Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I think that you may be right about that. Well, so Adam Rutherford's another example. He's a groupie of this Angela Saini, and he's half Indian or Guyanan Indian and half British. And he's rather like very left wing, anti-scientists, can't deal with issues like race in a logical way, uses lots of emotion. Even though he goes on about being a scientist, he's just published a book called How to Argue with a Racist. And he's obviously a fanatic and an anti-European, anti-science, anti-free speech, anti-civilization fanatic, just like Angela Saini. Perhaps if you have that, if you are mixed race and you combine that with being basically a bit unstable, low self-esteem, low self-worth, then perhaps the result of that can be that you just become this nihilist that just campaigns against civilization and campaigns against anybody having any sense of who they are, and just you're just destructive, basically.
Yeah.
But I would see that more as a manifestation of having the mental instability than necessarily being mixed race. And I suspect that if you are mixed race and you don't have those kinds of issues, then you probably just take a side. And I've met people that have done that. I was at the Traditional Britain conference, for example, and there was this young girl who was half Indian and half half British, half English, brought up in Britain, and she was at the Traditional Britain conference.
Yeah.
And I was at a conference of this Patriotic Alternative, and there was a guy there, I think he was half something Southeast Asian and half British. And again, that's you take a side, and you take the side that is the side of civilization. That's one thing you can do. So I don't think it's inherent in them being mixed race. It's if they're mixed race plus being mentally unstable and low. And that might be elevated amongst mixed race people, because if you think about it, mental instability is elevated among people who are fast life history strategists, and people who live for the last, die young, basically, who live for the now. And people who live for the now tend to take risks. They tend to take risks because they're evolved to an ecology where you could be wiped out at any minute, an ecology that's unstable and easy. So you could be wiped out at any minute. And so in that ecology, what people tend to do is they tend to take risks. And one risk is that you have a mixed race relationship. It's a risk. Of course, it's a risk, but that relationship could have a child that has some adaptation that wouldn't otherwise be there. And so, people who are very fast life history strategists do tend to be attracted to outbreeding, which is why the sort of black goes for blonde stereotype. Whereas similarly, at the other extreme, people that are slow life history strategists, they don't like risks. They tend to mate assortatively. They tend to even cousin marry, perhaps even, and so they mate with people that are similar to them, and so they eschew the risk of outbreeding. And so perhaps there would be elevated mental illness, but from the data I've read, there isn't.
Right. There isn't. Okay. Interesting. Hey, I wanted to ask you a little bit too, and we can obviously want to plug the book and everything at the end here too. But any thoughts on the coronavirus? I don't know if you've been following this at all. What do you make of it? Is it serious? Should we be worried?
I don't think.
Not really.
No, isn't it interesting that the only people that have died of it have been East Asian people?
As far as I've heard, that's the case. I think it was one who was, I think it was one who was mixed or something that had an issue in Germany. The first one, someone had died. The first one in a country outside of China, and it was either in France or Germany. I forget which now, but yeah, we'll have to see. Keep an eye on it.
But I don't know if that person was mixed. I think that person might just have been a Chinese.
It could be. Yeah, I could be wrong Chinese. On that.
And then there was an American that died in Wuhan or something, an American citizen, and she turned out to be Chinese American.
Interesting.
So I think that it's all of these things always become less virulent as they leave the epicenter. That's the first thing. Secondly, there are race differences in susceptibility to these kinds of viruses, based on the kind of history they have with agriculture and whatever else. And so, for example, the Spanish flu was much more devastating in Sweden among the Sami than it was among the Swedes. Because the Sami are less adapted to agriculture, they're less adapted to dealing with these kinds of viruses, and so they get wiped out by flu more easily than Swedes. And you saw this all over the place, and with SARS as well, that seems to be overwhelmingly East Asian. I think almost completely East Asian. I'm not aware that any non-East Asians died of SARS.
Right.
So that makes me wonder about the conspiracy theories that you may have heard of.
Oh yeah, it's published a good article, or we didn't, but I reposted a couple of places, Epoch Times. Many people have speculated if it was the bioweapon. The lab is of course in Wuhan too, and there might have been an accident. He might actually have gotten out of this. Was it level 4? I think they had in Wuhan a bio lab. They're dealing virology. They're dealing with these things. And it might have been a mistake. Some people speculate that it was the Chinese government themselves that have released the virus to cull the herd. But you know, I don't know at this point.
I think that's unlikely. I think it's more likely that they were developing a bioweapon and got out somehow, cock up rather than conspiracy. Probably
could be. Yeah, could be.
It would be consistent with a lot of what's happened.
I think one of the reasons why I brought this up too, with the virus and coronavirus and stuff like that, is that as we also continue to grow in numbers, as we're becoming more and more in the billions of humans, I think we're due for something big. I think nature steps in eventually and takes care of business if we're living in an unsustainable way. And I think another way that we might see this play out too could be something like this, a pandemic or something, or we're seeing some kind of massive disease or something within mankind that takes out a lot of people. I don't know. What's your take on that?
I don't. I mean, nature isn't conscious. It's not Gaia. It doesn't really sort of think about these things. So in that sense, there's no reason for it necessarily to happen. But I think that what would happen is that once things start to go backwards, then of course once we go back, which we will, to the level of medical care that we had in about 1917, then the virus is suddenly devastating. Because once you can't sustain antibiotics, once you can't reliably get hold of antibiotics, once the medical system is corrupt, once all these things start, once people sell fake antibiotics, once all these kinds of things start to happen, which they do in a society of declining intelligence, then you would think there would be a virus, just as there always has been these outbreaks of viruses. And it would be devastating, yeah. But at the moment, I think it's containable.
Hey, so tell us a bit about where we can get a copy of the book. And of course, you have a lot of them. I've been showing this page here on Amazon. Are they all available on Amazon, your books, or is there some that have been banned?
No. I don't write anything naughty like that. No. So there's all the almost all of my books, with the exception of that one on my ancestor, Sir Piers Dutton of Dutton, are available, or my collateral ancestor, are available on Amazon, as far as I know. If they're not, you can get them from the publishers, but certainly the new one, Why Is Love Make You Stupid, But Also Means You Conquer the World, is on Amazon. How Just Be What They Look Like, that was self-published on Amazon. And then I've got a new one coming out in a few months' time, which is going to be a Finnish translation of The Silent Rape Epidemic, How the Finns Were Groomed to Love Their Abusers. So any Finns that got that in English can get copies for their mums or their grands or whatever to read. And then I'm doing one at the moment on feminism. It's called Witches, Feminism and the Fall of the West, which I hope to have out probably at some point this year, which relates to some of the things we've been talking about tonight. But yeah, the new book is Why Islam Makes You Stupid, Also Means You'll Conquer the World. And I would suggest being careful going around on trains or buses in Pakistan or whatever reading that book. But cover up the top part of it. Cover up the top part with a bit of paper. So it just says, why is... also means you'll conquer the world, and then you'll be
then it's going to be okay. And yeah, exactly.
Then you'll be fine.
Lana mentioned it to me the other day, and I forget the details about it, but she said that there had been some update in the case in Finland regarding these rape gangs and stuff. Is that something you've kept up with? Do you have any updates
on
that?
Yes, with my new version of the book, there's going to, because the book was published in the English version, it was published in March last year, so there's going to be an epilogue. Oh, I've already written it, actually. Of what's happened since, okay. Which is that various of them have been given, frankly, abysmally light sentences in prison, a few years. Would get at least, so if you had to have sex with a 12-year-old, you'd be looking at 15 years in England for that.
Yeah,
it's the younger the child is, the higher the sentence. You'd be looking for serious prison time. And it wouldn't be nice either, like in a Finnish prison, it would be unpleasant. So it would be full of Muslims for a start. So I've done an update on that and other unpleasant things that have happened. For example, there was a woman of 85 that was raped by an Ethiopian in the washroom of her block of flats. That's come to light recently. And he had a tattoo on his arm indicating that he was part of an Ethiopian terrorist organization.
Yeah.
Which would indicate to you that he might not be the kind of person that the Finnish government should let in. But of course, the Finnish government doesn't have the interest of Finns at heart, so it did let him in.
That's right.
So that's pretty much what's going on. And then Jolly Heretic, which is my YouTube channel, and I do a new video normally every week, and I do live stream on Thursday nights.
Nice. What time on Thursdays do you do it?
At 9 o'clock UK time, so that would be, no, sorry, 7 o'clock UK time, which would be 10 o'clock French, Swedish, whatever time.
Nice.
8 o'clock your time and 9 o'clock Finnish time. Yes, 7 o'clock UK time, 8 o'clock Central European time.
Okay. And do make sure that you sub over on BitChute as well, because, of course, you never know what happens. We had actually one. Yeah, was it a later show we did with you? We got a strike for that video. I mean, they might pluck anybody at any time, it seems like. Depends on who's on the mood. And these Becca Lewises of this world goes around and flags videos or people that they don't like and stuff like that. So BitChute is a reliable way of getting your content, of course. Do you re-upload everything to BitChute
I have now, yes. There's a few things that I haven't re-uploaded, but I've got them on a compressed file, so I've got copies of everything. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I realized the other day, I'm not very computer savvy, I'm afraid, and I found the other day that I wasn't able to make any Photoshop. I wanted to make a thumbnail, and I couldn't. It kept saying that the scratch discs were full. I didn't know what that meant. and then I checked how full my hard drive was for the first time in years. And of course, I've been making these videos for the last year, and it was now in the red.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. There was no space. So then I had to delete the videos. But fortunately, I've got them all uploaded.
Back them up anyway, because you never know what happens. You know, services go down and everything. But all right. Well, great having you back again, guys. Check out a copy of the book. Here's, of course, a Finnish updated version of this is coming. So heads up on that. But again, the main one we've been talking about today is Why Islam Makes You Stupid, But Also Means You'll Conquer the World. So the message is, become more like the Muslims, right? That's the takeaway from today, I guess. Well, thank you, Ed. It was great having you back again. Really appreciate it. Always a pleasure speaking with you. It's always a blast. So thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, there we go. Thank you so much for joining us today. Hope you enjoyed it. We, of course, have two other shows with Ed Dutton, a.k.a. the Jolly Heretic, in our archives. Definitely check those out. Good stuff as well. I'm going to be back on Wednesday with the No-Go Zone. We're going to do a deep dive into actually some of the stuff that's happening in Sweden right now, unless there's something breaking that happens that's worth covering. But I wanted to go into the kind of the definition of the term, or a little bit of what actually happens in some of these areas. That will be coming up live Wednesdays. I do the No-Go Zone at 5 p.m. Eastern, possibly beginning 6 p.m. Eastern as well. Depends on how prep time goes as well. But either 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. Eastern. This is, of course, either 2300 hours, 11 o'clock Central European time, or potentially midnight if I start an hour later. Hasn't really set that yet. In addition to No-Go Zone, of course, tune in to 314. Tune in to Flashback Friday, obviously on Fridays, 5 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Central European time. And then we have Weekend Warrior exclusive at redicemembers.com. We have 133 shows in the bag, in the archive, if you will, as well. Definitely tune into those. If you haven't watched it, it's a great way of supporting us as well. Check out our memberships, redicemembers.com. We have 3-month subscriptions all the way up to 2 years available as well. And of course, it gets cheaper per month the longer subscription that you do get. All right, guys, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back with much more soon. Until then, take care. Keep fighting. and we'll see you next time. On October 17th, YouTube deleted our channel Red Ice TV, and a week later, Red Ice Media, our backup. We had no strikes at the time on either. YouTube never sent us an email, they did not get back to us regarding our appeal, and despite thousands of people writing Team YouTube, there has been zero communication from them after we were thrown off the video publisher's website. Luckily, nothing has been lost. Everything is still available on redice.tv and redicemembers.com, together with all our members' exclusive content. Make sure you get a subscription and support us. A lot of our recent videos and shows were automatically backed up on our BitChute channel. Subscribe to us there, bitchute.com/redicetv. More recent shows are embedded via BitChute on redice.tv, and we have always hosted our own MP3s on the website, the podcast version of the show. We have RSS feeds both for the radio show, the interviews, and a separate RSS feed for the videos posted on our website. Subscribe to both of these feeds to get the latest content, and this is a great way of getting a notification as well as soon as new shows and videos are available. We are in the process of uploading older shows to our BitChute channel now. We will go back and update shows on redice.tv that previously was linked back to our now censored YouTube channel. Subscribe to our BitChute channel, bitchute.com/redicetv. We are rebuilding our subscriber base with an already large audience over there. Join the 22,000 that have already subscribed to our BitChute channel. We are also uploading all our videos to our Facebook page, facebook.com/redicecreations. Just search for Red Ice on Facebook. When we live stream, we multi-stream both to Twitter and Facebook, but more importantly, dlive.tv/redicetv. Get the DLive app, follow us there, and you'll get notifications when we go live. They have super chats incorporated on the platform as well. Thousands have joined us on DLive already, and that's a great option for live streaming. If you want notifications for any of our content, make sure you join our Telegram group. Go to t.me/redicetv and enable notifications. You can get the Telegram app for your phone or your computer. It's nice and secure as well. Notifications goes on Telegram every time something new is available from Red Ice or other important updates that we have. In addition, make sure that you follow us on twitter.com/redicetv, gab.com/redicetv, minds.com/redicetv, and instagram.com/redicemedia. Help spread the word about our videos and shows. Share links, post it in comments, tell friends, family, coworkers. We lost access to 333,000 subscribers on YouTube, but we'll rebuild the audience on new and better platforms that don't censor and accepts politically diverse opinions. YouTube will be outcompeted by platforms that simply can uphold US law, recognize the First Amendment, but also the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. The Supreme Court already ruled that there is no so-called hate speech exception to the First Amendment. Publishers like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Google use the hate speech excuse, this clause, to silence dissident political views that they don't agree with, since they are biased political publishers that meddle in the election process and admittedly now has shown through leaked footage and documents that they want to sway public opinion by controlling what speech they allow or don't allow on their websites, even though they are granted special protection under the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, by the United States government. This means they should not be allowed to operate as a publisher like they do now. They should be a neutral platform, but time and time again, we have seen that they are not. All we ask is that these companies uphold United States law. Don't break the law by calling for violence, which we never did. And then these publishers should accept everything else that is protected under the First Amendment, since they are based in and were founded in the United States of America. They also receive corporate welfare, massive subsidies from the US government. This is taxpayer money, in other words. Considering their special protection status granted to them by the government under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, they should recognize free speech. And the US Supreme Court have already ruled that so-called hate speech is free speech. RedIce.tv, RedIceMembers.com. Visit our websites. A lot of great new updates in the work for both websites. Thank you for watching, and thank you for your support.